topic today is listed as minimal art and process art. And I'm presenting these maybe simplistically, that is, in a much overly generalized way, as examples of a masculine approach to art and a feminine approach to art. And I've been enjoying John Magnuson's topics on dreams, and I particularly appreciate the richness of his images and the kinds of issues he's been dealing with. And we talked a little bit this morning, yesterday, about the dimensions of the masculine and feminine experience. And I thought of all kinds of things I ought to introduce here, but I'd like to go back to some of these very simple generalizations I've been making. I quoted Hannah Arendt the other day in a book called The Human Condition that separates human activity into work and labor. And labor involved all those things associated with biological processes, with the processes of life, with sheltering, feeding, clothing, organizing, caring, teaching, cultivating the religious life of children or people, activities involving mutual aid, healing, touching. Those were all in the sphere called labor. And I suggested that generally we could call that the feminine sphere. That doesn't mean that men don't work in that sphere. And so when I talk about masculine, feminine, I'm not necessarily talking about these spheres being the exclusive property of men or women. And I pointed out that I spend a lot of time listening to colors and fine-tuning shapes, and I don't think that necessarily detracts from my gender. And Hannah Arendt also talks about the other area called work, and work is unnatural. It's those kinds of activities that are apart from life. They have more to do with culture, perhaps. The activities involved are often political. They often involve the economy. The activities tend to be larger, more public. And if there's artwork involved, it tends to be monumental in its character. And it tends to be done by men. And we call it fine art or high art. And so I would put those kinds of activities in the masculine sphere. And we'll be looking at some works today that are very public versus some works that are very private and intimate. And I'll make these same kinds of distinctions. I also made the large generalization about eros and logos. Logos is that principle which articulates, defines, separates. It's involved with words. It's putting things in categories. It's more rational. There's logic involved. And certainly, that's an important dimension of the human experience. But it stands in opposition to eros. And that's that principle that is connected to the erotic, that which unites people, which attracts people. It's unity created by desire. It's more subjective. It's more irrational, in a sense. Logos involves a kind of exclusive sorts of ideas, exclusive language. And eros involves inclusive languages. It includes all things. And so I tended to put these things into the feminine sphere. But I meant another category that I could make, or distinction, a large general distinction, would be classical and romantic. And I think that's basically what I'm trying to talk about. When we use the word classical, we think about the art and architecture of Greece. And these temples that sat on top of nature, their approach from the outside, you don't go inside of the temple, only the priest goes inside. The activity takes place outside of it. One's relationship to it is one of detachment. The temple itself is made up of a clear relationship of parts to the whole. there's a kind of mathematical order and unity to it, a system. And we could compare that to a romantic work of art. And maybe a good example would be the Gothic cathedral. And certainly the Gothic cathedral is not without a structure, but it's not as apparent. And it's an exoskeletal structure that you go inside of. And once you're inside of it, it's a little difficult to understand exactly what you're a part of. Because it's dark, it's filled with color, it's filled with feeling, there's more emotion involved. There's more mystery, there's the transcendent quality of the darkness of the ceiling. All of these buildings are dedicated to Notre Dame, Our Lady, to the Virgin Mary. So in a sense, they are the temples of this feminine presence. And I think I'm talking about classicism, romanticism, when I'm talking about these two poles. But before I get to minimalism, I was dying to figure out some way to get this painter in here. And I'm talking about the woman on the right. And I think it's a good general way to start today. But besides that, it relates to some of the things that John Magnuson is talking about. This is a portrait of Diego Rivera, the number one painter of Mexico, or at least one of the major painters of Mexico in the 20th century. He was a powerful figure, painted large public works, large public murals. And he was an overwhelming presence in the life of Frida Kahlo, K-H-A-L-O. Frida is his wife. And Frida is also trying to be an artist, a painter. And she has to paint in the shadow of Diego Rivera, which is a very difficult thing to do. Her paintings are very autobiographical. We've been looking at what I call autobiographical painting in the work of Artemisia Gentileschi yesterday, and Judith Lester to some extent the day before. But Frida Kahlo's paintings are basically about herself, and they deal in large measure with the problem of a woman artist being married to an overwhelmingly powerful public monumental muralist named Diego Rivera. I just wanted to start out with a couple of paintings I'm not connected here. One second. There we go. This is a self-portrait of Frida Kahlo with this, I don't know how John would describe this relationship to her husband, but she paints herself with that portrait of Diego with the all-seeing eye in his forehead. And that's this eye of omniscience and omnipresence, in a sense, sort of the eye of God. And there are tears in her eyes. And a lot of her painting is this kind of very personal painting about the problem of trying to be an artist in the presence of such a monumental figure. It would be like being married to Michelangelo or Leonardo, and one would have a certain kind of inferiority complex, I think, in that relationship. This is a piece of fantasy. This is a self-portrait with it's called the Universal Mother, the Earth, myself, and Diego Rivera, and she holds Diego as a baby in her arms, and she's in turn being held in the arms of the universe and of the earth. And I'm sure she's thinking here of the earth as a feminine principle, and Diego gains his strength and power from the woman, from the female. I think John would have a good time talking about this painting. But this is 1930s. Frida Kahlo might be called a surrealist. It shows how much she's involved in some of the exploration of Freud and Jung, who had a strong influence on the surrealist movement. This is self-portrait with shorn hair. She has cut off her hair, and she's put on a man's clothes, and obviously she's trying to become a man. Get another episode in this problem of how do you how do you function as an artist living in this kind of relationship? She also had a lot of very difficult personal problems which come through in her art. I'll show one example in a second. This is a self-portrait with this necklace as a kind of vine. And I think there's this relationship to animals and to birds and to butterflies. I think she's seeing herself as a kind of Mother Earth image or as part of nature, but that vine seems also to be strangling her. Here again, a portrait with a ring of thorns around her neck, which is causing a great deal of pain. But then against this floral piece on her head, how can one account for that earring is a problem. I think we can say that these are dream images which come from her own dreams and also from thoughts about her relationship to the world of art. This is simply called Roots. It's another self-portrait with herself as the source of life in this barren, broken landscape. And yesterday, in the dream session, there was this image, this archetypal image of the animal, and John pointed out that the injured animal is there's a strong possibility that it can be linked to physical problems within the dreamer. And indeed, Frida Kahlo suffered from a large range of physical problems. And there are a number of paintings about her surgery. She also had a very severe automobile accident and had to wear a body brace. So I think we can say that this is an example of the use of this kind of archetypal imagery that we've been discussing this week. I've mentioned this relationship before. In the background is the George Washington Monument. It's a very large, simple obelisk. It's a quotation from the ancient world. And I've suggested that it's a good example of a masculine image. It's an autonomous form. It's separate from nature. It's not related to life in any sense. I think it's supposed to be a vertical line relating heaven and earth, but I don't know that that's necessarily the reason for this monument here. It had that kind of function in the ancient world. It was the axis of the earth. Here it's a very large historical quotation, but I suggested that the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was an example of a feminine art form. And it was done by a woman, that's maybe beside the point. But it's a large, simple piece of black polished granite that goes into the earth. And it involves participation, it involves community, it involves searching for the name and going through the spatial-temporal process of discovering the name of the person that you're looking for. And we know that people bring offerings to this space every day. These are very carefully cataloged and put into a warehouse. But every day somebody leaves a memorial to their loved one. And you see yourself reflected in the work. Your relationship is one of involvement and participation. And you become a part of the work. And the relationship to the Washington Monument is one of detachment. It is an autonomous, self-contained thing in itself. But the other work is the exact opposite of that. And so I'm using this as an example of these two points of view. I will call the Vietnam Memorial an example of process art, and I'll try to explain that in a moment. And I would call the George Washington piece an example of minimalism in art. One more view of people entering the monument, you see them reflected in the work, you feel that sense of moving down into the earth. I think this work would be related to those divisions made by Hannah Arendt. It is a work that is related to life, to the process of birth and death. The space of the work it enters the earth, and so it's a part of, again, of the processes of the earth. And the Washington Memorial is imposed on the earth, and in a sense it's totally unrelated to it. So here you see the complex reflections in the wall, and it's an experience that has touched people very deeply. It's a work filled that stimulates deep feelings, profound feelings, maybe not in and of itself, but because of all of the ways in which you make connections in this work. The effect is overwhelming. So this is an example of minimalism in art. This is a galvanized metal box, iron box, and it's attached to a wall. And it has certain dimensions. It's probably 10 by 24 inches or something like that. The artist is Donald Judd. But Donald Judd can get on the telephone and call the sheet metal shop in Wenatchee, Washington, and order a box made to a certain specification and a certain quality. And he might dictate how the sides are to be put together, but he knows that this sheet metal shop will do a very good job. And then he has it sent to the Art Museum in Seattle for an exhibit. And it's exhibited as a Donald Judd. But he actually never saw the work, and he never touched it. It was all done over the telephone. So the work of art is exactly a piece of blunt prose. It's a fact. It's just there. And there's no way that we can talk about the artist. We can't talk about his involvement in the work. I don't think we can talk about subject matter, because it's not, there isn't any meaning that's apart from the box itself. No meaning extrinsic to the box. As we walk around the box, our point of view changes. At sometimes we see the end of the box, sometimes the side, we might see the top. It's very possible that the light changes. But basically, it's just this neutral thing. And the art of the 70s, for a variety of reasons, and maybe we could hint at some of them, and I take this art very seriously, but the art of the 70s moved sharply away from the art that had gone before it, that was very personal, very subjective, extremely autobiographical, charged with emotion and feeling, very much engaged in the images of American culture. I'm thinking of pop art and some of these kinds of forms. Suddenly, art became very neutral, and it became this art of things. The artist dedicates himself to the production of something that's really apart from himself. In a sense, it's a classical object. I don't know that we get involved in any kind of personal architect or sculptor or painter in Greece, although we do know who did these things. But I think they all tried to achieve a kind of anonymity and detachment from their work. And there is a kind of a perfection about what the Greeks did, and I think Donald Judd is interested in good craftsmanship and perfection. But he's using a very humble, simple material. So he's not interested in making a work of art that's extremely precious or valuable. He simply wants to make a work of art that is just an object, a thing. So what you see is what you get, in a sense. And there is an extreme reductionism that's involved in the production of this work. And maybe I'll move on to the next one. There's an extreme reductionism in the artist's point of view. He simplifies the work down. He takes himself out of the work. We've been talking about biographical works. Last weekend, I talked about Mary Cassatt and George O'Keefe, and we see their brushstrokes, we see their presence in the painting. We go over to the center and we see Rich Kammerer's decisions as his brush hesitates or slows down. But in this work, we can't find Donald Judd because he isn't even here. He's back in his office on the telephone ordering some work for an exhibit. So I think this is an example of this masculine point of view. There's precision, there's order, there's repetition. No one part is more important than the other. We're not really, the artist is anonymous. We're not really involved with the artist. The work is set apart from nature. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with life at all. All that remains is you, the spectator. So the object, in a sense, you are the object of the work. You have to move around. You see it from this point of view. You walk around the front of it. You see it from that point of view. You see, sense the spaces between the objects. You see it from the other end. So the work, in a sense, is changing it. To some extent, the work is participatory. But there's a sequence here, and I think there are all kinds of relationships and analogies we can make. We can think about mass production, we can think about factory production, because these do have a factory-like quality to them. We can think about automobiles coming out of the assembly line. There are all kinds of ways in which this is reflective of the lifestyle of the modern world. But there's also, I think the point of view is very strong in music. And in music, the sounds are made with electronic devices, with synthesizers and so on. And very often the sounds are based on a very simple motif, just a couple of notes and all of the variations, mathematically all of the variations that are possible on just a couple of little notes. So in music, art form has become extremely simple. And there's a celebration in the sense of boredom and banality and ordinariness and uneventfulness in these works. And I can't account for that. Completely. I think we can look at what's happening in the world in the 1970s. Maybe this is the only thing that one can say for sure. I mean, the world, our country was involved in Asian affairs. There was a great deal of dissension in this country in the 60s. Maybe we can say this is escapist art. I can't account for it completely, but I can see a lot of factors in the world that might lead one to want to contemplate something that's absolutely simple, absolutely clear, non-threatening, non-hostile, non-aggressive. It's simply there. And it's a very elegant kind of object. But I'm thinking of a musical composition, Philip Glass, Einstein on the Beach, a 5-hour opera. And the stage is a large series of cubes with the singers stacked up in the cubes and with a few musicians, and the lyrics for the opera are the numbers 1 through 10. And for 5 hours, the choir sings 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, forwards and backwards, inside out, and overlapping in fugue forms. And at first it's maddeningly boring, and it just destroys you. But the longer you listen to it, the more you get involved in this simple sequence of sounds. And I think you, in a sense, you get hypnotized, and suddenly it starts to impinge upon your consciousness. And I think you do get deeply involved in it. One of the images is the image of the countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, liftoff. And there is that kind of sequence that's so much a part of modern life. And I can't help but think that that's a part of the general context of these kinds of images. These sequences that either lead to liftoff or to destruction, to annihilation. And maybe this is the last gesture in that direction. But Donald Judd continued to make these absolutely neutral forms, which are probably never touched by him. They're conceived like an architect conceives a building. He might make a drawing. Somebody else makes the work. He leaves the person out of it. He leaves the subject matter out of it. And all that remains is the material. The material might be dense. It might be rough. It might be shiny, slick, soft, hard, thick, thin. That's one of the things that we can respond to. But otherwise, we can only get out of it what we want to get out of it. So it's all up to us, the spectator. This is a series of stainless steel boxes arranged vertically. Sometimes the mathematics is subtle, and the spaces between the works vary. They get larger as the boxes get smaller. So he plays with different kinds of systems as he creates the objects. Now, this is in the Walker Art Center. This happens to be a very handsome object with a polished aluminum box and mill surrounded by a blue plexiglass form on the outside. And indeed, light does do wonderful things to this neutral object. And as you walk around it, it does change. It's almost like an impressionist painting, the way light plays with the form. Perhaps it's a reflection of super technology, and maybe it's an attempt to humanize or make more accessible some of this, some of the sequential nature of the computer, or maybe to some extent it's related to our architectural forms, which have that same kind of simplicity, just the endless repetition of a module in the glass boxes of our cities. Carl Andre arranged self-contained autonomous groups of forms on the floor. He uses different kinds of metals in large square formats, and you're invited to walk on them. And it's amazing how sensitive your feet are through your shoes, because you can feel a difference between the different metals. But he wants the work of art to be, again, just a fact. He doesn't want it to be anything other than itself. He doesn't want it to have any meaning other than itself. And itself is this square with these clear internal relationships. There's no ambiguity, no mystery, no subjectivity. It's all just there. And it's very common and very simple, and it's made out of ordinary materials. There's nothing precious about it. There's no glue, there's no technique involved. The only technique is gravity, which holds these things to the floor. So the whole tradition of art, I think, in a sense, is being questioned here and thrown out. European art specifically, with all of its subtle, complex relationships and its nuances. And all that remains is this matter of factness. This is a group of fire bricks on the floor in the Tate Gallery of London, and the Tate Gallery paid a small fortune for this little pile of fire bricks. And the City of London was outraged by this, but the board of directors of the Tate defended their purchase and said that Carl Andre was a very important point of view in the 70s, as he takes these very ordinary objects and arranges them in a very simple form in a certain distance from the wall. So the room itself becomes a part of the work. There's no illusion of space, there's just real space. There's the corner of the room, or the floor, or the wall, or the ceiling. But there's no trickery or no games. There's simply these facts. In painting, the point of view is also very similar. The painting is about three colors, red, yellow, and blue. This is by Bryce Marden. It has no texture, no surface. It's very it's ornamental. But it's absolutely neutral. They're impressive. They're very large paintings. The color is always exciting. I think the minimalist point of view really does work better in sculpture, because color is so emotive. But I think they wanted to leave out emotion and feeling. So these are series of forms. They're all identical. Once the series is started, he follows it through. He doesn't change his mind. He makes a commitment to a simple point of view and executes it with very careful application of thick, opaque layers of paint. There are just a couple more examples of sculptures that are called primary structures. And they really come out of the same point of view as the minimalists. And all of our cities suddenly have these forms. This is by Tony Smith. They're extremely large, dramatic forms, metal forms, imposed on the landscape. I would say this is a masculine point of view. They're large, autonomous, self-contained, aggressive shapes that stand there sort of lording it over the space. One of the good things that they do is to play as a contrast to the kind of static nature of the architecture of our cities. But nevertheless, they're impersonal. They don't have much relationship to the human. They're large and monumental and heroic in their proportions. They're very aggressive in their posture and their attitude. I think they're very exciting. And they're also very masculine. This is a piece developed for a GSA built government services building in Washington. Tony Smith, it's a composition of polished granite blocks, which are placed together in a simple V form, which stands there and, in a sense, in dialogue with the severe architecture of the building behind it. These are a little more active. This is Clement Meadmore at the gallery in Columbus, Ohio. Large steel forms that become twisted knots. They're more active, but they stand there in their own little autonomous world, set apart from the city. Again, they're exciting contrast to the city. Large expressive gestures. And I would call that a large masculine gesture. It has a kind of an authority about it that's powerful and demanding. So I think that's the last of this minimalist point of view. In music, again, this use of electronic devices, of computer-generated rhythms and sounds, of dense, overlapping, but very gray kinds of patterns that don't really go anyplace, I think, it has affected popular music, rock music, all those kinds of forms. People are using machine-generated sounds and patterns as a very important ingredient in their musical form. But the other day, when I was talking about Mary Cassatt and George O'Keefe, I mentioned Alice Aycock. And Alice Aycock made this maze. And I compared the Egyptian pyramid with the labyrinth. And I think those two images are good images of minimalism and process art. Because process art is that art that really relates to biological life, to the forces of nature, to life processes. And it stands in strong opposition to minimal art, which is autonomous and separate and doesn't seem to apparently have anything to do with life. It's more related to logos. It's a clear, simple, strong form or statement that's set apart from life. The image of the labyrinth or the maze, I think, is a very good image of the feminine principle in nature and in art. And there are many male artists. Some of you know Jackson Pollock, and I think Jackson Pollock's imagery was always the maze. It's this confusing image. It's an ambiguous image. It lacks clarity, but it's an intriguing image. A maze is a form that you don't get anything out of unless you go inside of it. And once you're inside of it, you don't quite know where you are. There's something frightening about the maze. There's something terrifying. Alice Aycock made this because she went off into the Utah desert one time in a 66 Oldsmobile, and she got on a Jeep trail, and she got lost, and she thought she was going to die. She was really scared stiff. And she and her friends wandered around in the desert in this street automobile, and they came back upon their tracks, and they didn't know where they were. And she always thought of that image of the maze, of getting out there in that space. But the maze or the labyrinth has always been a very strong theme of both defense, of enclosure, of imprisonment, but also of mystery and ambiguity. And So I talked about this the other day as a very strong feminine image, one that you enter into and participate with, but it's not clear exactly how you should behave when you're there or where you should go. And when you get there, you don't know how you got there and you don't know how to get out exactly. And I think there's a lot of that quality in some of the works we're going to see. This is another Alice Aycock. It was built on her mother's farm. It's a system of underground chambers and tunnels. And it's an underground maze where you walk around in the dark in this cellar. And I related it to going to Grandma's house, which was a big old house, and it had an attic. And it was always fun to go up in the attic and poke around between the boxes. But it was also kind of spooky. Or it was fun to go down in the basement of Grandma's house because it was an old house with rock walls and it had coal bins and big furnaces and places to hide. There were adventures in going down there and moving around in that space. A lot of Alice Aycock's work has dealt with these kinds of constructions that relate to very human kinds of experiences. Maybe you think this is a waste of time. She doesn't mean to impose this on anybody. It's out there on her mother's farm, and it's not causing anybody any trouble. And if she wants to go to all the bother of building it, that's fine. But the person I wanted to contrast to Donald Judd's impersonal boxes is Ava Hess. She was an unusual young woman at Yale University. Her life ended tragically short. She struggled with the problem of a brain tumor. But she kept on working in spite of this, the inevitability and the very apparent terminal nature of her illness. She's of Jewish origin. Her parents, her parents fled. I think some of her family ended up in concentration camps, but I think her parents were able to get out of Europe. She married another escapee from Europe. That marriage tragically ended for a number of reasons. She became involved in art, but then she contracted or developed a tumor, and she knew that her days were limited. Her art stands in strong opposition to the minimalist point of view, and she seems to go out of her way to break the rules. She was a very stubborn kind of woman, a very special student of Joseph Albers, if any of you know who that is, the chairman of the Yale Department of Art, who admired her a great deal. Well, her work can be called process art because it uses some of the forms of nature, and in this case, a very strong element is gravity. She started to use untraditional materials, and I think they have a lot to do with her own hospital experiences. So here, I think, in opposition to Donald Judd, we have artwork that's quite autobiographical. She uses gravity to control the drapery, the draping of these cords. The cords are ropes which are wrapped in strings and in fine material so that the ropes have a kind of body to them. Then those ropes are covered with translucent latex rubber materials. And so they have a kind of organic, lifelike quality to them. And then the shape that they're hanging from also is made of synthetic materials, resins and rubber-like materials, so that light shines through it. So the works deal with two qualities in nature, light and gravity, and that controls a lot of the shape and form of the work. They seem to be informal and irrational and absolutely arbitrary, yet I think there's a lot of control. These kinds of works disturbed the critics. A lot of people didn't take them very seriously, but suddenly people realized that there was quite a different kind of person on the art scene. And she spawned a lot of similar kinds of works in the crafts. This is a large construction using a basic wire armature that supports ropes which are wrapped in fine linen strings which are then covered with latex rubber. So the work is somewhat permanent and somewhat rigid, but it's shaped by forces of nature, it's shaped by gravity, and it stands in strong opposition to the very controlled geometric forms of these male artists. She was asked, isn't this latex rubber rather temporary in its nature? And she said, yes, it is. And she said, my life is temporary. And she was aware of the temporary nature of life itself. And so she made a point that point out of the fact that art doesn't necessarily have to be an immortal kind of act. And it's not necessarily there to enhance her immortality. She saw herself as part of the life and death process that was going on within her own body. She was very reluctant to use some of these synthetic materials because synthetic materials are toxic, and she didn't want to do anything to further damage her very fragile kind of life. But in spite of all of this, she continued a very prolific output of these kinds of forms that grew out of her own biography, grew out of her own illness, her own treatment, but also very consciously related to nature. This is a stainless steel mesh used in a hospital situation with tiny latex rubber tubes used for intravenous treatments, and she put these little tubes, folded them, and stuffed them through this stainless steel mesh to create this lifelike kind of form. It has this inner life, this inner texture, and the rubber tubing is transformed into a kind of telescopic view of microscopic things that are happening in the body. Small hairs, small sensitive kinds of surfaces. This is a detail of the surface with thousands of little tubes with which she built this sculpture. These are polyethylene forms that were placed in knit bags which she made and dyed herself. And gravity formed this malleable material until it took that kind of very natural kind of shape. And these forms hang from the ceiling. So gravity shaped the forms, and they're the same kinds of shapes and forms that we find within the human body. So again, I think the organic nature of these things are a clear indication of her attempting to make contact with her own physical being. So there are all kinds of variations on these forms which use the processes of gravity or the intrinsic qualities of materials themselves to create the shapes. These are translucent fiberglass, resined, latex rubbered forms that seem to, it's nothing we've ever seen before, and yet I think we can identify with these shapes and with these sort of umbilical cords that hang down on the floor and relate to these cell-like structures on the wall. These are fiberglass resin pieces, again, shaped by gravity, played with by light, with processes of nature. They have skin-like qualities, light shines through them, they have a kind of inner glow. They work very simply in the space. I've seen some of these and they're quite elegant. They're very mysterious. You do take them seriously because of the kind of strange nature of the materials that she chose to work with. Series of cell-like structures. It's a very simple, it's the same kind of geometry that Donald Judd was using, but these aren't neutral because of the translucent nature of the materials. The piece on the left is called the Lowakhuan, which was that famous Hellenistic sculpture of the father and the son struggling with these serpents. And she made a very rigid structure and then of metal, and then inserted these string-covered, latex-covered ropes, which form the same kind of struggling contrast to the rigid geometry of the tower itself. There are a number of these wrapped forms, latex string rope forms that feel like bologna or like organic kinds of shapes. That's a separate piece over on the right. So nobody had ever seen anything like this before. A lot of people ignored her. Yale thought this was very exciting and supported her. Lucy Lepard is a major art critic, and she wrote a monograph on Eva Hess and is very appreciative of her work. And there aren't very many people like her. I think there's a connection here with Frida Kahlo, the woman we started out with, because they are very personal kinds of works. I think she might have done them even if she hadn't been undergoing this hospitalization. And even if she hadn't been facing the inevitable termination of her life in probably a very short time. A series of very large forms which are attached to the floor, they're worm-like, they're bandaged, wrapped, they're with tissues and gauzes and latex materials. They seem alive. They're caterpillars, they're worm-like. Maybe there are erotic implications in these works. They form an interesting space of, they're like trees, they're like plants. There are human associations here. So, a couple more examples in a slightly different mold. This is Stonehenge in England. We don't know exactly what Stonehenge is. We think it's a very sophisticated device for measuring the universe, the cosmos, the position of the planets. How could these dumb old primitive people way back there know these kinds of things? How could they build this structure? For a while it was believed that druids built this because on the summer solstice the light shines through a certain place in the circle and falls on what seems to be an altar stone. It's a large sculptural composition that relates to nature, obviously, and to the universe, to the stars, to the heavens. And so in a sense we could say it's in the general category of process art, which is involved with natural processes and procedures. And there are a number of artists working with the landscape with forms that directly are directly connected to the sun or the moon or the stars or to the weather. And such a work is Nancy Hope. This is at the University of Washington at Bellingham. It's a series of stone circles with openings that are very carefully oriented to the position of the sun and the moon. And at certain times of the day, it functions like a clock, and at certain times of the day, the light forms inside move around in that circle and complete certain kinds of revolutions. And at different times of the year, the shadow patterns and the circular patterns are quite varied. This is a view looking inside. There are a number of these apertures, and at certain times of the year, these lights line up, and the shadows line up. And one senses a connection to nature, to the universe, to the passage of time, to the seasons. All of Nancy Holt's work have been these kinds of devices that have this really huge and monumental kind of job to do. I'm sure she's thinking of herself as a descendant of the builders of Stonehenge. This is a piece at Lake Placid. It's 30 feet tall. It's a tower with different kinds of openings, and on the inside there are strong light dark shapes that are constantly changing, sometimes obscuring the nature of the cylinder and sometimes clarifying it. This is a view of the inside as you see the movement of the shadows around in this dark interior space. Like the Vietnam Memorial, it's something that you have to go into and become a part of. And I think you focus on some of these things that maybe very often you take for granted, the position of stars. This is in Nevada. It's a work. This is only a detail of a large work of some huge culverts out in the middle of the desert, arranged in such a way that it performs wonderfully at winter solstice and summer solstice. I have a friend teaching at Carleton whose son was born on the summer solstice, and they made a family pilgrimage to this space, got there early in the morning, and watched the sun line up in these containers. And the whole family agreed that it was a very thrilling experience to be there at that precise moment, which only happens once a year. Nancy Holt made this piece for the city of Saginaw, Michigan, and it's a kind of time clock, a sundial. The patterns on the ground keep changing constantly, but I think when you get acquainted with it, you can use it to read the position of the sky in the same way that the builders of Stonehenge used that form to create their structure. Well, the last person is a man, and I think what he's doing would reside in this feminine sphere that I've been trying to define. His name is Christo, and he works as a team with his wife, Jean Claude. And his original work had to do with hiding things, with packaging things, in a sense with putting shrouds over things. And when you put a shroud over something, you mystify it. A shroud reminds us of death. A shroud, we cover our coffins with shrouds. We cover an accident victim with a shroud, with a blanket. There are all those kinds of implications when you take a very well-known and familiar object and put it inside of some kind of container. And a lot of his first works were to take very ordinary and to underline the fact that we're surrounded by mystery. John Magnuson has been talking about this other dimension, the ace card, the wild card, this mystery, the spiritual, these dimensions that we think we're aware of, but we can't quite articulate. And a lot of Crystal's projects are on a monumental scale. This is a model for the wrapping of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, a piece that was actually carried out. Both the inside and the outside were covered with this polyethylene material, and it was tied sort of irrationally with ropes. So the identity of the building was hidden. And when you went inside of the building, the inside was also hidden. And suddenly the familiar becomes very strange. He has a proposal which he hopes someday to realize, and that's the wrapping of the Reichstag in Berlin. And this would involve the cooperation of the four superpowers, and it would involve the expenditure of a great deal of money. And it would be these conflicting powers in our world coming together to do something that's absolutely nonsensical. But it could be that ultimately the process of coming together to do such a work would result in some new kind of unity. So I would say that the principle operating behind these works is that of Eros, that which unites and builds community and pulls things together. He wrapped a large piece of the Australian coast with I don't know how many thousands of yards of this synthetic material and ropes. It took a large army of people to come together to execute this project. The projects only last for 2 weeks. And after the project is over, the materials are very carefully removed and no damage ensues. But part of the work of art is the complicated procedures that go before the actual execution of the work. And so that's part of the process. And that involves getting the Environmental Protection Agency to go along with this, to get the National Seashore Agency to go along with it, to raise the money, to pay for it, to get a manufacturer to make the material, to convince a lot of people that it's worth doing. But there's no point in it other than that. Again, it's maybe it's a reminder of death. Maybe this is a shroud, but maybe also it simply underlines the kind of fascinating, powerful mystery of nature itself. But the project I wanted to end up with is the Running Fence in Sonoma and Marin counties from 1976. This is a fence that's 24 and a half miles long by 18 feet tall. and it involved 4 years of very difficult work and lots of controversy. And it was only up for 2 weeks, and when the project was over, the materials were given to the landowners, the cables were removed, and there was no evidence that it had ever happened afterwards. But it took 4 years of negotiations and town meetings and argument. First of all, Christo and his wife came to visit these ranchers, and they said, "Get out of here, you New York hippie Jew." And they didn't want to have anything to do with this guy. And he wouldn't give up, and he kept talking to these people, these farmers, these ranch owners, and proved to them that he was no commie freak from some other world. And little by little, he won them over, and they got very excited about the project. And they started to support him. They started working with city councils and county boards and commissioners, environmental protection agencies. And there were all kinds of attempts to block the project. But he knew that he was going to win. He knew that he wasn't going to give up. And he organized a large army of workers from San Francisco, students and others. This was a carefully orchestrated, carefully calculated work. He got a manufacturer to make this tremendous amount of white nylon. He collected all of the hardware, and he executed the work. And it becomes one of the most beautiful memories of the 20th century. Some of you maybe have seen this. The ranch owners became very protective of the work. Some of them slept out there to guard their section of the fence. I've seen movies of this. The wind played on the cables. There was this gentle tinkling of sounds. There was the gentle bellowing of the sheep and cows rubbing against the fence. And it articulated the topography, the shape of the landscape. It articulated and defined the space. I think it gives one a sense of the nature of that, those two counties, in ways that maybe nobody had ever thought of before. It was no arbitrary work. It was very carefully calculated. He knew exactly where every part was going to go. He left openings in the roads for the cars to pass through. I talked to people who were here, and they said it was really a wonderful experience to see this new kind of landscape as it wanders up and down, sort of like the Great Wall of China, except that it's not there for defense. But what it did was bring hundreds of people together, created a community. And I think it was a community of enthusiastic participants. And it was for no practical reason. There's no value to this. But I think of all the great monuments we built, the Washington Monument, the great memorial arch in St. Louis. Those things stand there forever. But I wonder if ultimately Crystal's running fence isn't much more significant, maybe only in the memory, but we can only read about it, we can only see the films. The piece rises up out of the sea. These are some of the workers building the strong fence because it had to withstand the wind. This part was extremely controversial, and there were court orders to block it. Christo almost ended up in jail, but he went ahead with it anyway, because he's violating the National Seashore, which is a protected area. St. Olaf College was given a piece of land in Marin County, and the vice president of the college went out to see this land to see if it was worth accepting. And he happened to stumble on this thing. He came back and said, called me out and said, "Who is this Christo? Have you ever heard of him?" He said, "I just had the strangest experience of my life." He talked about running into this fence. And I knew about the project, and I asked him what he thought about it. He said, and he's a real tough, nuts and bolts, matter-of-fact, good, solid businessman who doesn't spend a lot of time with the visual arts. He said it was a wonderful experience. It was very important. He was glad he was there. And he talked about the ways in which maybe it changed his life. My school is very healthy and solid, probably because of that man. And maybe I'm glad he doesn't get spend all of his time going to silly art events. But I think he became more humane because of what he saw here. See, this didn't cost anybody any money. It cost millions of dollars, but Christo pays his own bills. He sells books, he sells drawings and films, and he pays the bill. So I don't think we can charge this thing against hunger or poverty or any of those things. It was an event, a kind of a celebration of nature that engaged hundreds of workers, and who knows what the effect of that will be on the future. It was a very peaceful kind of act. Christo has inspired a lot of similar kinds of activities. In some ways, these works militate against the whole idea of buying and owning the work of art. You can't buy it, you can't put it in a museum, you can't resell it for a greater value. You can only remember it, you can only be a part of it, and then it's over. And I've been talking to John Magnuson about some of the Indian traditions. Art was a throwaway kind of thing. It was for an occasion. It was for a liturgy or a ritual. And it was not to be owned. Once it was made and used, it was over. Works like this, and to some extent Donald Judd's works, have a healthy dimension to them. I think it would be good to get back to some of that notion of art as celebration or as a natural part of and part of the fabric of ordinary life, something that everybody participates in rather than something that's very special.